Okie dokie. So, here we are. This is Greenhorns Radio, and I'm Severin, your host, and we are joining, well, we are hoping that you are joining us, radio listeners, for another session of Greenhorn Radio for young farmers by young farmers. And today we're talking with Charmaine. She is my friend from Seattle. And
hello.
Hello, Charmaine.
How's it going?
How's it going? Were you out there? What's the weather like?
The weather is overcast, but it hasn't rained, so I had a nice time doing chores, and it wasn't too freezing cold yet, so it was a nice day.
Nice day in the fall in the Pacific Northwest. Will you mind describing to our listeners your kind of daily chores and the kind of operation that you're running in your hybrid farm urban life?
Oh, sure. So I live on a pretty standard size city lot. It's about 5,000 square feet, which I think I did the math and it's about a 16th of an acre. And we have, I just went out and fed our chickens. We have a flock of nine laying hens and a rooster. And the reason I can have a rooster is because I live about six blocks south of the city limit. And my rooster is also kind of quiet and not so annoying, so that's a good thing. And
but what about your sheep?
The sheep project just wrapped up. The sheep are all freezer trained right now, so they're living in our freezer chest, and we're gonna enjoy some wonderful meals of lamb as we have been this winter. And I'm getting a couple of milk goats this in a few weeks here, so very excited about that. And we also have a few meat rabbits and several garden beds and lots of perennial edibles. And we're just trying to maximize efficiency and space on our little farm here.
So you are running this urban farm, and you were doing the sheep project, but no longer. And then what are you doing in the nighttime?
In the nighttime, I'm a full-time musician. That's what I do to make money to support my farming. it's a good time. We play for square dances, and we were just at an old-time music jam last night in the Columbia City neighborhood, and we do a lot of community building kind of stuff with the old-time music and square dancing. And my partner Charlie and I are in a duo called Squirrel Butter. We sing a lot of songs, and then my bigger band that place for a lot of the dances is the Tall Boys, and there's four of us in that band.
Well, and I can attest to the danceability of your fabulous music because...
Oh, thanks.
Because
that was a really fun party.
That was a really fun party we had in the Grange Hall in Vashon. And I just got an email today from those kids out in Madras who wanted to put together a mixer out for the Small Farmers Journal annual horse-drawn auction and equipment sale.
Oh, cool.
So we may have yet another chance for collaboration.
That would be amazing.
That would be amazing, huh? Okay,
yeah.
So the Tall Boys and Squirrel Butter during the night,
right.
And during the day, small-scale homesteading in
small-scale
Seattle.
Small-scale farming, yeah. And then,
what else is going on?
I help run the new Seattle Farm Co-op.
Now, there we go. Now, this is the crux of the matter, everybody, in case you haven't been listening so far. Now is the time to start listening. What's the big idea with this cooperative you got going here?
Well, the big idea is we've got a pretty quickly growing population of urban farmers here in Seattle. It's really exciting. It's doing a lot to raise awareness of farming in general, and people are getting back in touch with their food in the city, and there's just a bunch of wonderful things that are happening with the urban farming here, mainly because the city kind of updated their urban farming policies and made a lot of things legal to do in city limits, which is really great. All these farmers sort of needed a place to buy their supplies, and I was personally driving like way out to rural areas to go to the feed store to get what I needed for urban farming, and it got to be kind of a chore and didn't really make a lot of sense and costing a lot in gas. And so I was on this listserv, and this gal, Amy Stevenson, who is the other co-founder, posted a message that she was kind of sick of doing the trek out to the feed store, and I responded to her email, and we decided to get kind of a buying club together to start purchasing mainly chicken feed. And that quickly grew from the first order, had about maybe 30 or 40 people that we got together to make it happen, and it's quickly grown to a listserv of, we're almost at 1,000 people now on the listserv.
And this is over the course of how many months? Holy smokes, that's fast.
We're at about 3 years right now.
Wow.
And we just actually officially finished our incorporation as a co-op. There's a lot of paperwork. So we sort of operated as an LLC with the intent to roll into a co-op when we get the paperwork done. We just finished the paperwork in September, filed with the state, and we can now legally accept paying memberships. And we have about 130 paying members right now. So those are people who have bought their lifetime membership fee, which is $50, and pretty interesting. So there are people who are vested in this project now financially, which is really great.
So, you know, those of us who are in the food world are quite familiar with some of the Headwater organizations. There's the, you know, Madison Co-op. There's the Park Slope Co-op, there's the Oklahoma Food Co-op, there's the Wedge, there's, you know, these amazing institutions who have really, and here in the Hudson Valley, we have the Honest Weight Food Co-op with just thousands of members making food affordable and, you know, keeping the margins manageable so that you can have sustainable and organic food at working class price range. When you're dealing with feed, does the same rules apply, or what kind of scale do you have to operate at to get the kinds of savings that you would expect as a wholesale purchaser?
Well, all of those things do apply to us, and that was a part of our mission statement, was that we wanted to keep these items affordable so that urban farming wasn't just a luxury hobby for the middle class in the city. We wanted to see urban farming become a viable food resource for low-income families. And so there were a few feed places in Seattle at the time that were kind of boutique pet stores that were selling feed. And the prices for a bag of chicken feed were astronomical. It was just like not doable for a standard family. You know, it's very kind of boutique-y feel to the price level. So we found it was going to be important for us to keep our prices as low as possible. So to save on costs, we're totally volunteer run at this point. So there are no paid employees, no paid labor, and all the members are, well, not all the members, but all the volunteers are members. So we have a core group of 5 people on the board, and then we have a growing staff of warehouse workers who host open hours, and so our open hours are not set every week. It's just kind of whenever a volunteer can come in and open the store, and the volunteers need to be trained, so they're a pretty dedicated crew that we have going in there, and it seems like we get a few more every month, which is really great because it takes the pressure off of everybody else to host enough hours to keep the store running. So so that's kept things financially viable, and we pretty much barely break even at this point. And we pay the bills, we pay the rent, and we're pretty happy about that. So the fact that we can provide the service at that level now is great. And for long-term sustainability, we would like to bring in enough profit to be able to hire 1 or 2 people to actually run and manage the store. But I think that's still probably a little ways off. So,
well, this is the thing about the new, you know, the new ideas and the innovative business models is figuring out how to make it go and how to keep it going once it's started going. And have you talked at all some of the people who I know who are similarly serving the urban farm supply chain? Like Naomi in Portland and my friend Novella in Oakland. I know they're both selling by pallet. They buy in pallets. They're not a cooperative. What are your experiences kind of looking around in this sector of the new sector of urban farm supply?
Well, we really tried to buy in pallets as well, and we're in also the sticky place of wanting to buy organic as much as possible, buy locally grown as much as possible, and of course that all affects the price point. So we've tried to bring in a range of different feeds that are all pretty much local into this region. We have some certified organic feeds, those kind of have the top price point. We have some locally grown and milled feeds that are also up there, and then we have some conventionally grown feeds that are locally grown, and those kind of bring in the lower price point. So we've tried to bring in a range of products so that our clientele can all have something that's decent quality to choose from that's in their price range. So it's been helpful to be able to source all those different products, just and most of them are in Washington State or the Northwest, so that's really great. Another thing that we tried to be sort of creative about was all the chicken supplies, rabbit supplies, goat feeders, things like that. We're trying to source those from local carpenters, and we've been soliciting our membership to build these products, and we'll sell them on consignment at the store. And that way we're getting away from some of the big galvanized steel products that come from China and stuff. So we feel good about that decision and help support the local economy and maybe a local artisan or carpenter who needs a little extra cash. So,
well, this is one of the wonderful things about agriculture as an economic driver and as, you know, a very solid foundation for, you know, the new economy, which we, of course, in our lifetimes must build, is that you just there's so much damn stuff needed by farmers, and that really provides such opportunity for, as you say, the carpenters, the processors, the metal workers, the fabricators, you know, we just wrote a grant for this Arduino, which is like a little robot. Well, actually, I shouldn't talk about it. It's not done yet. But anyway, the point is that, you know, the manufacturing sector possibilities for smaller scale tractors being put back into production, so we're not all using stuff from the 1940s.
That's cool.
I feel like there's so much potential in it, right on that you're having stuff made. It's hard. I went to the feed store the other day to try and get a heated water trough for my pigs to overwinter. And even though they're 3 hours from Boston and 4 hours from New York City, they didn't have anything that wasn't made for horses at that feed store.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like stomped my foot.
It's very frustrating. Yeah, because it's the pet owners that really drive the industry, and so many feed stores do have gradually started catering more to the kind of pet and hobby industry than the working class farmer who's really on a budget and needs something that's functional but not fancy. And so we're trying to instill that value in our urban farming community, that if you can DIY it, that's best. If you need us to get you something, we can. Hopefully we can get it locally and locally made. You know, if not, we do have access to some of the bigger suppliers to get things that are commercially made. And as a farm co-op starting up, it was really amazing, like, how quickly we were really hit by solicitations from the big ag suppliers, as we like to call them, like all the people that like Horizon Distribution and some of those big names that supply some of the big outfits with all of their goodies. Once they heard about our co-op, we were just getting letters and calls and emails and stuff to start accounts with them, and we're trying to get as little as possible from them. It's nice to be able to get a few select items from them as needed, like a hog trough warmer. But we're trying to avoid doing big scale ordering from companies like that.
Well, the thing that I've really am cherishing about this, as I'm understanding it, is that you're bringing, you know, it's a completely values-based business, and you're coming in with a very clear set of goals based on thrift and efficiency and local, supporting local businesses, and that is in essence going to drive the decisions that you make for more high quality, you know, things that are going to last for a long time. And those are the values that have been absent, I think, from a lot. I mean, I go through these catalogs and it really, you know, it takes an education to just know what gear is going to bust up in the first year and what gear is going to last.
Yeah.
And being able to interpret. Sorry, go ahead.
And as a co-op, like, we have that flexibility. I think if we were doing this as private business owners, we would be so much more in the mind frame of turning a buck to be able to make our business feasible. And I really, in starting this project and kind of seeing the financial line that we walk, if I was doing this as a private business owner, I would be totally freaked out and be very stressful, and I'd have a hard time resisting temptation to get a lot of that junk that you're talking about in the store just to be able to push more products to make more money. And it's nice to have that sort of value-based system, as you mentioned. And I think it's all because of the cooperative business model and the fact that everybody who's invested in our business and shops at our store is a member. We do sell to the general public. Most people who shop with us have become members now. So, and members save. One of the benefits of becoming a member is you get a 12% discount on everything across the board. And then you also have the opportunity to volunteer to get another 18% off of items, depending on the amount of time that you work. So, because of that, we've been able to attract some out-of-town farmers even to volunteer with us. We have one guy who farms 3 hours out of Seattle, but he has a computer job in town during the week. So he volunteers at our co-op. It's a big discount on feed. And in turn, we have him as a volunteer worker, and he's very knowledgeable. He works, you know, he has a real farm and can answer a lot of people's questions regarding feed and garden minerals and things like that. So that's another nice way we've been able to get some education sharing and skill sharing in our co-op.
Well, that's the thing that is so powerfully a part of the tradition of cooperation, and almost like this is something I wanted you to maybe reflect on as someone who is, you know, part of the culture and old-timey music and starting this cooperative in a kind of unusual, untraditional fashion. Could you reflect on the kinds of relationships that are made possible by, combining commerce with conviviality, I guess? Like, what's happening in your little incubator there of agrarian revival?
It's so cool. I mean, we're really fortunate to have this great community in Seattle, and in many ways, you sort of mentioned it was untraditional. In many ways, it's like the original traditional, and we've just moved away from that. And it's nice to have a way to get back to that. And coming into the old-time music was probably the first thing that got me going on all this community stuff, because I just met all these wonderful people through old-time music. And I was living in Seattle. I wasn't playing music. I wasn't really doing anything fun. I was working as a veterinary assistant, which was great because I loved working with animals, and worked with animals all through my youth and did 4-H. And I grew up in Montana, so I grew up in a rural area doing more rural farming kind of stuff. But when I moved out here, I couldn't really find that community until I just stumbled upon the old-time music community. I went to a festival with a friend. I had no idea what kind of festival I was going to. She had mentioned it's like old traditional music, and I was thinking like Irish music. I don't really know. So we got to this festival and opened the door, and I just was pounded by the sound of these amazing fiddles. And I looked around, and they were all people of all ages, and that was just a really inspiring experience for me. And through hanging out at that festival, I just noticed that there were little things that made the community feel really just honest and trustworthy, and like people were leaving $1,000 instruments laying around and not worrying about it. And part of it was, I think I noticed, was that there were multiple generations hanging out. And I think anytime you get sort of one generation of people all doing the same thing, there's a tendency for that group to become kind of cliquey and maybe take each other a little bit too seriously, maybe be a little bit competitive. But in an environment where there are many different generations of people hanging out together, everybody sort of relaxes and doesn't take each other too seriously and kind of lets their guard down. So that was a very nice thing that I took away from that festival. And it took me a while to realize that. I kept reflecting back on, why did that situation make me feel so good? And these are some of the things I kind of pondered on for a long time. And out of that event, I just couldn't stop thinking about finding that community in Seattle. That festival was in Portland. And I met some people from Seattle there, connected with them in town, started playing music with them, dancing, learning how to play, and learning how to call square dances and stuff. And it just brought so much joy to my life that it was important for me to keep that up. And the whole time I was thinking, what are some other things I could be doing in my little corner of the world to make the world a better place? And since I was getting into music, I was for the rural lifestyle, but didn't want to leave my community I'd just found. So I found out you could have chickens in Seattle. That got me kind of going on the chickens, started gardening more intensively, and kind of gradually moved into this building of an urban farm community. So it's been wonderful to be a part of all of that. And I feel really fortunate that there's all these great people around too. See the light.
it really all comes down to feeling the good feelings, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. And you know, it's it was about that time that my dad was passing away, and that really made me think about my life and what sort of legacy I wanted to leave behind. And I was like thinking about the 9-to-5 and working really hard and not finding much joy, and that's when I decided to just sort of bag all that and play music and do what I felt was right, and it's all really worked out for the better for me. And I live on a shoestring, but I'm very happy, and that's really the most important thing. So, whereas before I had money, but wasn't that happy, so.
So, Charmaine, I don't want to impose it on you, but I do have the sense that you are evangelical enough about your cooperative that you would be open to speak with other people about their own ideas and initiatives if they were to email or call you. But would you just give us that presence on the web and maybe just tag a few resources that were really useful to you in the formative stages of this project that you might encourage others to check out?
Absolutely. Co-op information can be found at seattlefarmcoop.com. And you can email me at Charmaine, C-H-A-R-M-A-I-N-E, at seattlefarmcoop.com. And some really useful resources in starting the co-op. You know, it's kind of funny. We were in a situation where we were sort of making this agricultural co-op, but it was in an urban place. So there were a lot of grants and stuff available to co-ops forming in rural areas, but there weren't for urban areas. So if you are in a rural area and you want to start a co-op, there are lots of grants and resources available for you to do so. It was a little harder for us because we didn't have those things at our disposal.
The rent is more expensive in the city than the rent is in the rural places.
Yes, we have a lot more competition from like standard private business, and so it didn't make a lot of sense that we couldn't get more help. But there, in Washington State, there is an organization called the Northwest Cooperative Development Center. they do help all the people with developing co-ops in rural areas and taking advantage of those grants and pointing them in the right direction. So I think they're under nwcdc.org, or you could look up, you could Google Northwest Cooperative Development Center. There's probably other such centers in other states as well, and it's a nonprofit organization. And one thing that a lot of the co-op organizations are working towards is opening some of those grants for more suburban and urban co-ops that are forming up. So hopefully that will change in the future, and the geographic location won't be a dictator as to whether or not you get a grant. It was just really helpful for us to research other co-ops and see how they were handling various parts of their business, and that we borrowed a lot of ideas from other co-ops, and the great thing about co-ops is there are these seven principles of cooperatives, and one of them is co-ops support co-ops. So you can always go to another co-op and say, hey, can you help me out with this? And they're usually more than likely to give you a hand, so that's very nice. And as far as old-time music and building community that way, you can find me through oldtimeseattle.com and certainly shoot me an email about any of that. I've met a lot of people all around the country who are doing cool things with old-time music, and I love it when the old-time music and the farming communities collaborate on stuff. So we've had a lot more of that happening in this region, and it's really, really fun and cool.
Well, it's really, really fun and cool to be here with you on the phone, and I can't wait to be back out there. If this mattress thing comes through, that'd be amazing. But until then, I wish you all the best for the winter wetness over there. And I thank you so much for joining for another episode.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Have a wonderful day. This has been another episode of Greenhorns Radio, Greenhorn Radio. I'm Severin, your host, director of the Greenhorns, which is based here in Hudson, New York. Our mission is to promote, recruit, and support young farmers, and we are happily doing that all over the country. If you are on the East Coast and you're thinking about conference season, I would really recommend you check out NOFA New York. That is happening in Saratoga on the 20th of January weekend. And there's also NOFA Massachusetts and NOFA Vermont and NOFA Connecticut. Other regions, check out our website events page. We'll be doing a mixer down at SOG in the Southeast and other places all over. So check us out, www.thegreenhorns.net, and have a lovely day. Bye-bye.
Ah, blues out on the ocean, blues all in the air. Yeah, I can't stay here no longer. Got no steamship pad. When my mercy cries are over, cast my body out in the sea. Save all the undertaker's bills, let the mermaids flirt and eat. Wife controlled my happy home. Sweetheart, I cannot find. Well, the only thing I call a home is trouble and a worried mind. When mercy cries over, cast my body out in the sea. I save all the undertaker's bill, let the mermaids flirt with me. I save all the undertaker's bill, let the mermaids flirt with me. Do not work for pleasure. That's a piece I'll see no more. Well, the only everything I work at home is drive the world from my door. When my mercy cries out over, cast my body out in the sea. Save all the undertakers, build that mermaid's serving me. Well, blues all in my body, sweet has forsaken me. If I ever see her face again, I got to swim across the sea. When my mercy cries over, cast my body out in the sea. Save all the undertakers, build that mermaid's serving me. Ah, save all the undertakers, build, let the mermaid's serving me.